It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We'll follow up that all-day special coverage for NPR of those hearings in the House Judiciary Committee. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at law at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me again.
Well, it's been a long one here today. What stands out to you from this marathon testimony today?
Well, what stands out to me most, first off, is the incredible partisan divide that we see here. If we've been talking about already how Congress seems to be broken and divided on so many other issues, it's equally divided on this in terms of the interpretation of facts and the views on the process. Because think about it here. The Democrats are saying that the evidence is sufficiently clear that the president has abused its authority such that it rises to a constitutional harm meriting impeachment, and also have argued that the process is basically fair. Republicans, it's less clear if they dispute the nature of the facts, but clearly say it doesn't rise to a level of constitutional harm meriting impeachment, and object to the basic fairness of the process. And so we're at an enormous divide in terms of how Democrats and Republicans view so many things here.
Let's look at the process for a minute. Both sides argued about that, as you just mentioned. People view this as, in some cases, an analogy to a grand jury investigation. This isn't the place where the trial is done. That would be the Senate. Is that a fair analogy? So we wouldn't see the usual sort of cross-examination of witnesses, that kind of thing?
Yes. I'm going to say, I always tell my students, yes, think of the impeachment process and Senate trial as indictment and then trial, but then forget everything I just said, because and I say that because it's not a criminal inquiry.
Right.
Because if it were a criminal inquiry, we would have a lot of clear things to be able to resolve. We would have clear issues regarding evidence. We would have something simple as what? In a criminal trial, all of us have watched probably too many trials on television, from television shows, and we know, for example, to find somebody guilty of a crime, it's what? Beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't have any of those clear standards in criminal trials, and so even though we start with that analogy, not a bad way of thinking about it, immediately forget what I just said and think of it as more what? A political judgment inquiry in which it's not clear what the standards of evidence are and what the rules of burden of persuasion really have to be.
Right. This is a process denoted in the Constitution, but not very well defined, right? The Constitution says the House is in charge of this part, the Senate's in charge of this part, and then we kind of wing it?
We sort of wing it. There's only four clauses in the Constitution that refer to it, and it doesn't give us a lot of language. We have some House rules. We have some Senate rules. Still, that we don't have a lot on it, because what? This is only the fourth presidential impeachment inquiry in history. And I think if we include also members of the judiciary, because judges can be impeached also, we're looking at 14 impeachments in history, not a lot to work from. Now, to make it even more complicated, the U.S. Supreme Court said in a impeachment inquiry or a case before it involving an impeachment many years ago, that largely impeachment in the trial is delegated to Congress. And why that's important, the court has basically said, we're not going to second guess what Congress does here. And so, for example, you couldn't, let's say, if there was an objection on evidence, bring a case in federal court. Let's say the president were impeached and the Senate did actually convict him. He can't appeal it to the Supreme Court. So we're dealing with a process that is so unique and with so little examples, especially at the presidential level, that we don't have clear guidance, and there's a little bit of winging it going on.
Talking to David Schultz, political scientist at Hamline University, also law professor at the University of Minnesota, looking at today's session of the House Judiciary Committee, getting testimony from congressional staffers, in effect, who had worked on the Intelligence Committee reports from both parties. David, do you see that as unusual? Republicans definitely made the case that this is unusual. We just have congressional staffers, high-level staffers, obviously, presenting the findings on behalf of the Intelligence Committee.
Well, again, this comes back to this whole nature when I opened up my comments about things being broken here, is that generally you have staff like this that's operating on behalf of the entire committee, and you would hope that these nonpartisan staff are going to be, fairly representing, all sides here. But yet again, going back to the theme in terms of how partisanly broken we are, we now have accusations that there's sort of Democratic investigators and non-Democratic or Republican investigators. What intrigued me was around, I think it was around maybe 2 o'clock, no, I'm sorry, take it back, around 3:30 our time today, approximately when they started asking questions about who's giving political contributions to whom. I mean, that really sort of shows us, the degree to which this has really broken down. I'm not sure if you recall listening to that part also.
Mm-hmm. Right. They were saying, did you donate X amount of money to Democratic candidates or causes, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and also talking about, did you ever do any tweets or social media about the president like that? Yeah, so they're really trying to sort of go to the argument of saying that, listen, you folks are not nonpartisan or bipartisan. You're clearly in the camps of the Democratic side.
And it was clear that that was their role here today. You had the Democratic staffer making the Democratic case, the Republican staffer making the Republican case.
There's no question about it. And this becomes kind of dangerous now, because I think in part what's going to happen if the Republicans are criticizing the House inquiry as being partisan and biased, look what's going to happen now when we get over to the Senate. Because when it gets over to the Senate, assuming there is articles of impeachment, assuming he's impeached and it has to go over to the Senate for trial, the Republicans are going to be in charge. And now the Democrats are going to be able to lob the same hand grenades against the Republicans in terms of saying, well, listen, you acquitted him or you did certain things simply because it was partisanly driven. So at the end of the day, the ability of the Republicans to be able to come back now and say after an acquittal, assuming, again, a trial and acquittal, it's going to leave the Democrats now open for being able to say you folks were also tainted and you had your Republican people. So it gets us to a point where both sides are going to just label the other side as being partisanly driven and really not giving the American public much of a face in the fact that this entire process from either side was done well.
Well, we heard all day what did happen. I want to talk about some of the things that didn't happen and looks like they won't happen. One is, and Republicans brought this up, not bringing fact witnesses in front of House Judiciary in particular. And let's start with one group of people that could have been called, the people who did testify privately and or publicly in front of the House Intelligence Committee. What do you make of that decision to not bring them back in for a round of questioning with a different committee?
Well, I think this is kind of interesting. Now, I could see the argument being made from sort of an efficiency standpoint or to try to sort of maybe save the wear and tear on the witnesses. But in terms of the fact that the House Judiciary is ultimately going to be drafting the articles of impeachment, perhaps it would make sense to bring them in again so that this committee could talk to them and gather information from them. But again, I'm just not sure from a practical point of view, bringing these witnesses in would have changed any minds. I don't think Democrats would have shifted, and I certainly don't think Republicans would have shifted. And that might have been a tactical move made by the chair at this point to say that nothing's really going to happen as a result of bringing these additional people in. The only thing that I think it would have made a difference on, and this is what's surprising me about the Democrats and right now in terms of this whole process here, is that part of why you televise, partly why you broadcast on radio these type of hearings, is you're educating the American public and you're trying to get them to understand what the issues are. Because again, if this is ultimately, as Alexander Hamilton said in Federalist 65, if impeachment decisions are political judgment issues, the American public needs to sort of hear and weigh all the evidence. And what I'm concerned about is that oftentimes, especially during the holidays like this, the American public is worried about a dozen other things and not impeachment. And so I'm surprised that the Democrats have been moving on this during the holiday season and are trying to get this done before Hanukkah, before Christmas. I actually think it would make more sense if they wanted to make this process better educative in terms of the American public, that it carry over into the beginning of the year. So there just may be, from, let's say, a political tactical point of view, some mistakes that are being made in terms of not bringing witnesses on for the American public to hear them.
Another group of people not testifying, Republicans saying, hey, we don't have firsthand witnesses. Democrats saying, well, that's in part because President Trump told all the people in the government, in the White House anyway, not to come forth and testify. What about the absence in front of House Intelligence or House Judiciary of a bunch, I think 10 or so, or some people said 10 or 12 different White House officials who might have first-hand accounts to share?
You know, that actually becomes a legitimate argument that I think the Democrats can come back with at this point, is to say that when the Republicans accuse and say we don't have that firsthand evidence. Well, first off, remember, it's not a criminal trial, which means rules of hearsay evidence don't apply in something like this. And you can bring in hearsay and secondary evidence. But if, in fact, you do think primary direct hearing or direct evidence from people who heard the conversation is critical. The president has basically said at this point, you're not going to testify. I'm not going to comply with subpoena requests, and has said what? I'm not going to cooperate with the impeachment process whatsoever. So the argument to say that you don't have this information probably isn't a strong one, but at the other hand, it does strengthen the arguments for the Democrats to be able to say that what? We have an obstruction of justice charge here or an obstruction of Congress charge, so that even if it doesn't support necessarily the primary charge in terms of what's happening with the allegations of what we'll call it the quid pro quo with President Zelensky from Ukraine, it supports perhaps a obstruction of justice charge against the president.
What about the argument that Democrats shouldn't rush through this? They should take their subpoenas of Trump administration officials to courts, get the courts to rule on it, to have a shot at having those key witnesses testify.
Well, again, this cuts two different ways. I think the Democrats are first making a calculation and saying that they want to, you know, they're not sure how long it's going to take the courts to resolve these matters. The courts could take a few weeks, could take a few months. And I think they're sort of viewing it as saying that we just want to get this done. So I think there's a calculation they're making on their part. On the other hand, there is some merit to the argument of saying that perhaps the Democrats should let the courts do some of their job. Because if we think back to both Nixon and the Clinton impeachment inquiries, the Supreme Court weighed in significant ways that affected the impeachment process. So it really sort of cuts in two different directions here in terms of waiting for that. But at the end of the day, if they don't have the information they need from the president regarding, again, the phone call, they perhaps have the information they need to bring an obstruction of Congress impeachment charge.
And another thing, we aren't seeing, at least according to Democrats, key documents. It isn't Democrats saying it's not just that the White House said, hey, people don't talk. They also said, hey, people don't release documents. Is there a sense of the kind of things Democrats on this committee would want to have seen?
I think there is, and I think there would be documents here that perhaps the president could have provided to maybe support his contention that, again, this was not a quid pro quo or that he wasn't doing anything nefarious. And the fact that he's taken an absolutist position, I am just not going to cooperate, I think has created a problem for Democrats in the sense of saying that do they let the president of the United States stonewall them to the extent that it undermines the ability of Congress to do its job and to check the president of the United States? Or do they say at some point the president has decided that he's not going to cooperate and in a system of checks and balances and separation of powers, we're going to take the appropriate action we need to take? I think Jerry Nadler, Chairman Nadler's sort of closing statement was kind of making that argument in terms of saying that that's really what we have to do at this point. When the president refuses to cooperate and refuses to basically defend himself or provide the supporting materials for Congress to do its job, the only recourse is what? Is to go the impeachment process.
Now, going back to the hypothetical, you mentioned earlier that, yes, in fact, the House does vote to impeach. This goes to the Senate. We've seen reports that some Senate Republicans have been meeting with White House officials to talk about how this might be handled. That's a case where the analogy between a trial hearing and an impeachment falls apart, because generally in a trial hearing, the jury doesn't consult with the accused.
Exactly. And that's the part that's really strange here at this point, because, right, if we were doing a criminal analogy, I don't think too many people accused of crimes get to negotiate out with the jury on what to do. But this still does create a problem, though, because under the way the framers seem to have envisioned the impeachment and the trial process, the Senate would be acting kind of impartially in terms of being able to render a judgment about whether or not the president was fit to continue to stay in office. But here we now have this unusual situation where it doesn't look like the Senate's going to be acting impartially. And think about how the impeachment process was originally conceived. And people forget about this. When the impeachment process was originally set up, it was what? When the senators were selected by the state legislatures and they weren't elected, and it was when the Constitution was first drafted, the framers didn't believe that political parties were going to exist or were desirable. Fast forward us 230 years, we now have elected senators and very partisan senators. The way this process looks now and the way it operates is very, very different. And I know when that story first broke also in terms of conferring with the president, I thought, to what extent does this undermine the possible neutrality or hopeful neutrality that we would hope that senators would have when they're listening to the charges being brought by the House against the president of the United States?
And as we start to wrap up, David, the process in the Senate, again, they get to set the rules as they see fit. One possibility is they could try to get all the things we talked about that haven't appeared. They could issue, for example, their own subpoenas. They could subpoena documents. They could bring other people back in for testimony and allow the president's lawyers to cross-examine them. All the stuff we haven't seen yet, in theory, could happen in the Senate.
You're absolutely correct. And so they, for example, they could subpoena Joe Biden. They could do Hunter Biden. They could essentially put the Bidens on trial. They could bring everything in that, you're right, has been excluded here, and therefore, again, open themselves up equally to the charge they've been directing against Democrats, that it's just a partisan witch hunt, the process is flawed, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to be pretty significant in terms of when the shift goes over to the Senate, because it's that shift in partisan control. And I suspect we're going to see a shift in terms of what information comes in. And now think about some tactical considerations here. We're going to be potentially looking at a trial going into what? At the Iowa caucuses start, maybe Super Tuesday, depending on what the timing is. And to what extent could that timing affect the prospects of, I think it's what, still 4 or 5 Democratic senators?
And I'll jump in. Thanks to David Schultz from Hamline University and the University of Minnesota. Get more on the Ideas Network tomorrow. This is Central Time.